Facing challenges and overcoming setbacks is part of doing business. Whether you have the expertise to survive them or not could mean the difference between success or failure. Welcome to We Are Women, featuring revealing conversations that provide invaluable insights into the success secrets of female masterminds. A must-listen for every entrepreneurial woman. Now here's your host, Janine Vosper.
Hi, it's Janine Vosper here, and welcome to another episode of the We Are Women podcast. With me today, I have trainer and coach Angela Heiss. Now, Angela spent her whole life dedicated to understanding the why behind human behavior, offering insights and practical tools now to help people improve their lives by better understanding themselves. Angela grew up in a family where women were considered inferior to men, or as a grandmother put it, always walk the lower path. Now, early in life, Angela became aware that this sort of didn't match her perception, which really, namely, that the women in her family were often stronger than the men, but didn't believe it, and therefore lived unsatisfying lives that were full of drama and resentment. So Angela decided to break with tradition and to live a life that would please her, no matter what her family thought about her choices. Angela was born with itchy feet, so far has lived in 10 countries, worked in 17, and travelled to almost 50 countries. Now, true to her attitude as a curious explorer, Angela's career has not been a straight path, but a winding road. So listen to this. So Angela has worked as a researcher in New York Chinatown History Project, a teacher of English in Taiwan. She has run an Asia-wide business on furnishing textiles from Hong Kong and created national discussions as a TV producer for a sex infotainment program in Germany and managing a complementary health seminar network in Australia. That is such a wide range. We're going to have a lot to chat about, Angela. Now, Angela decided to take her experiences, a lot of experiences in there, the information and the tools that she'd gathered to make a difference to people's lives. Wow, that is certainly an awful lot. Welcome, Angela. I'm so looking forward to our conversation. There's so much diversity in what you've done and where you've been and the responses, that this is going to be a really interesting conversation. Welcome this morning.
Thank you, Janine. It's wonderful to be here. I look forward to talking.
Yeah, there's so many things just from that introduction as to, you know, at what age did you sort of look at your family? Was that something just as a child that you went, because that's very perceptive from a child's point of view.
Well, I started reading very early, and I was always interested in what made people tick. I was one of those really pesky children who kept saying, "Grandma, why is Dad the way he is? And Grandma, why is Mom the way she is? And what were your parents like?" And I grew up 5 kilometers from the Neanderthal, you know, the proverbial caveman.
Oh, and okay.
So I always had this interest in what made people tick, why did we keep repeating the things that I knew were making us unhappy? And, you know, so I think I was about 14 when I came to the conclusion that we hadn't far evolved from the Neanderthal.
We still had our set roles, did we?
Yes. And not just women, but also men. And, you know, how we interacted with each other in families. And it was not just my family. I mean, it was also my other friends. You know, I talked to their parents, and I just kept wondering, why are we doing these things? And, you know, so dysfunctional, and you know, we were just so attached to being unhappy when there was so much potential for being happy out there.
And has that changed much over the years, you know, looking at families now?
Well, I think we're much more conscious than ever before. I mean, the expression conscious parenting did not exist when I grew up, let's put it that way. And there was definitely no positive psychology either. So, you know, it's like we looked when I wanted to study psychology, it was about rats and statistics, and I wasn't interested in that.
No, that's very different too. I'm very interested in what makes people think the way they do and the choices they make. So, yeah, I agree. Rats wouldn't really rock my boat either.
No, so I decided that was really not the way to go. So I took a little bit of a detour and studied history and Chinese. And I studied cross-cultural history, in particular, American cross-cultural history, because you can find out a lot about people by looking at you know, when they immigrate to another country, what happens to them? How do they deal with emotions? How do they deal with values? And where do they fit in? Where do they decide not to fit in? And especially in this so-called, you know, air quotes, the melting pot of America, of the United States, that just didn't happen.
Okay, so that's particularly why America was such an interest to you, and I suppose you're seeing that in Australia as well. But do we do it differently than the Americans do, or the people arriving plus the people that are here?
Yeah, I think we do. America was the country where people came because they wanted to make a better life for themselves, whereas here people originally came because they were supposed to be here, or they were sent here because they couldn't make a life in England. So it sets up a whole different paradigm. It sets up a very different culture and belief system. You know, so it's either you think that you're entitled to making a life and you can do it, or you're not allowed to make a good life and you're punished for trying to do that.
Okay. So, That's really interesting perception on that. I hadn't considered that. So that's part of doing that then. And then you moved to Asia then. So that's a big step, you know. So what was that sort of the impetus to sort of go from studying that in the US and then moving into Asia?
Well, originally I went to Taiwan because my Chinese just wasn't good enough. And I really wanted to become a professor. And so I decided that moving to Taiwan would give me two opportunities, A, to learn the language, and B, to really work with the people I had studied so far and get a, you know, firsthand experience. Because even when I was at UC Berkeley and when I was in New York Chinatown, I was working with academics and I wasn't really working with, you know, regular people. So it was going to Taiwan was a big adventure. I mean, I ended up working for one of my clients and started doing business at a time where I had absolutely no idea what business was actually about. None.
And that's like, there's two points that are interesting there. The one is that that client felt that you had the skills to step into that role because it was a, like an only managing director type of role, wasn't it? And then that you just went, oh, okay, I can do it, and just went ahead and do it. There's, you know, there's that he had belief in you, obviously, and then you just said, well, of course, then I can do it. Because a lot of people get so hung up, and that's probably, you know, with you stepping out of your role, they get hung up into their role, into what their capabilities are, and whether they feel something came up in a webinar that I ran earlier this morning about being worthy to take on something like that. But if you're challenging things all the time, then you just step into it. Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, there was more to that than that.
I don't think I've ever believed in failure. I don't believe that things don't work out. I mean, take it from a reformed perfectionist, ironically. I mean, I love doing things really well. And I also believe that there is no failure. There's just learning. So when I took on these roles, I mean, I have taken on roles. Like when I took my job in Hong Kong, I was on the plane and went, oops, I totally forgot to ask how much they're going to pay me.
And, okay.
And then I went, you know what? If it doesn't work out, I can always leave. I'll find something else. And I really live by nothing is more. What is it? There are two things that are inevitable in life, death and taxes.
Yeah.
Everything else is negotiable. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. So that's really important to me. And to keep that mindset, I actually challenge myself to do something new every year, something that I've never done before.
And what sort of things are we talking about here, Angela?
Oh, all sorts of things. Physical skills, mental agility. So I did salsa dancing because I grew up convinced that I couldn't dance, that I was really clumsy because that was one of the beliefs in my family. That I just wasn't the physically most agile person. Apologies for...
No, yeah, I meant to mention to listeners too that you very bravely come on this morning was because you've got a cough as well. So that's fine. You need to take a drink of water, then by all means do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So the other things I've done is if you really wanted to, if I really believed in failure as such, is I did a course in quantum mechanics for non-mathematicians. And I was out after the third session. I just didn't. That did not work for me.
I can imagine me, myself, going, what am I going to study? Let's go quantum physics.
Well, there was this whole connection between spirituality and quantum mechanics. This was at the, around the time when What the Bleep Do We Know and all of that. And I thought, I'll give it a go. Yeah. And then the other thing that I did, which I'm actually still quite proud of, is I did a course in theater sports. And that's all about improvisational theater according to, with very funny rules, you know, where you have to say things A to B. You know, it's like one person starts with a sentence with A, the next person has to start a sentence with B and so on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. I'm in a public speaking club, and whenever we do the impromptu stuff, that's my forte. I just love doing that and using humor as well. Yeah.
For me, that was one of my things to break perfectionism. Right. It scared the living daylights out of me. On my way to the third class, I all of a sudden realized that I had taken a U-turn and was on my way back home again. I was so scared.
The physical body took over. Is that what you're saying? The subconscious took over.
Yes. So I turned around again, took a deep breath, turned around again and went there and did it. And it actually turned out to be quite fun. Once I let go of all sorts of preconceived ideas of what it should be like and really improvised, it was wonderful.
Yeah, and that's the thing is we don't do that enough, do we? You know, that's a big challenge to do something that really scares you. And as I said, you know, as someone who coaches people in public speaking, that's one of, you know, the biggest fear. What did Seinfeld say? They'd rather be in the coffin than giving the eulogy. But and so to step out to do that, you know, I see so many people start and they make that first little step out, and then you don't see them again. You know, the panic and the fear overtakes, or they do a U-turn without realizing that they've done that.
Well, ironically, you see, I have always done things that I really enjoyed, but public speaking for me, since you're mentioning it, was an absolute nightmare. I mean, if you had told me 25 years ago that I was going to be a trainer and presenter and that I would speak sometimes in front of hundreds of people, I would have said, you're absolutely crazy. Pigs will fly.
Yeah.
I could not talk to more than three people without getting so tense that I would literally get sick.
Yeah.
But I married an opera singer.
Okay. So, how did that sort of then make you step out as a speaker?
Well, he was a trainer as well.
Okay.
And he was able to really present really well. But as soon as he stepped on stage, he had lots of stage fright.
Okay.
So, and I had learned lots of tools in the meantime on how to deal with people, you know, like manage working with people. And so I said to him, you know, how about we give those a go? Mm-hmm. And so we did. And all of a sudden he was very different. Mm-hmm. And so his colleagues all said, well, we want what he's got. Mm-hmm. And so I started working with them. And then, of course, it was like, now you have to present this in front of groups. And I'm like, no, I'd rather be the one in the background.
So that was do what I say, but not, yes, I have to do it as well. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And so my ex-husband said, no, you have to do this. Mm. You absolutely have to do this. You have something to say. And also, you really need to walk your talk. And I went, yes, you're absolutely right. So I did. Mm. And that really put my life onto a whole different trajectory.
Wow. Yeah. It is. See, that's the thing, isn't it? You may think you're going along a particular way and your life looks like there's this plan out in front of you. Then, you know, there's a whole lot of things that can happen to people. There's that they can have deaths in the family. They can have divorce, lose their jobs, do a whole lot of different things. And I know from reading your biography, there was a whole lot of those sort of things that happened to you as well. Yeah. But sometimes it's a simple little thing like going and learning how to speak in public and not be fearful of it that will change, that makes it one of the biggest changes.
Yes, absolutely. And I would recommend that to everyone.
Mm.
I think there's not a single person that would say, no, I think you should not speak up and say what's important to you. It's a wonderful tool to actually learn to be assertive, to speak out, and to get some more of that I call that marshmallow-coated steel. You know, it's like be personable on the outside and have that steel on the inside that supports us when we really need it, that also puts boundaries in place. And public speaking does that because we learn to actually stand up for ourselves, don't we?
Absolutely. And it's one of the things that I think it's one of the best skills that anyone can have is to be able to do that well. Because you and I just I'm writing a new book and it's called the first one was Good Girls Do Sell, but this one's Good Girls Have Influence. And part of it is revolves around mindset, but part of it is about being able to speak out and how to do so. It's really good. It's really important. So can you give us a little tip of, you know, just a little technique, how you worked with those people over and your husband overcoming his stage fright?
Well, one of the things that we do is when we think about something that's about to happen, what we do is we actually go into that event and we imagine what it would be like, especially when everything goes wrong. Because our brain has actually what's known as a negativity bias. So anything that doesn't work weighs much more strongly than what could potentially work, because the brain wants to make sure that we're prepared for the worst so we can handle that. So when we go into this event, we imagine what's going to happen. We go into this, let's say we're giving a public presentation and we imagine all the things that could go wrong. I mean, people can get so scared that they faint. You've had that, right?
You know, Barbara Streisand suffers stage fright.
Yes.
And she gets physically ill before she performs. You know, that's amazing that someone that looking from the outside going, wow, she's such an accomplished performer.
There are a number of Richard Burton had so much as that was one of the reasons why he drank so much. He would often go on stage absolutely drunk because he couldn't handle it otherwise. And he still he still was an amazing actor. I mean, imagine what he would have been like if he had been sober. Who knows?
Maybe not as good.
Maybe, who knows? So what we do is what I would always recommend is to people, instead of focusing on what could go wrong, you're not in charge of that. There could be all sorts of things that could go wrong. I gave a presentation once and in the middle of the presentation, the fire alarm went off. And, you know, we all had to leave. So I actually continued the presentation in the parking garage. But, you know, but there are all these things that we have absolutely no control over. Technology can happen. People in the audience could do all sorts of things. And we take that very personally, even if it has nothing to do with us.
Yeah, I know. I talk about the baggage people bring into the room themselves, which has got nothing to do with you as a presenter, Nick. And it's hard for perfectionists to deal with the flexibility that you need to have.
Yeah.
Not just presenting. I mean, we're talking about life, isn't it? It's that flexibility to roll with the punches.
Yeah. Absolutely. So the important thing is to just prepare. I mean, I don't recommend to people going into a presentation and just winging it, because that's a surefire way of actually not doing it. But when you're prepared and you know how you want to feel afterwards, that's the most important thing. There are all sorts of things that can happen during the presentation, but what you're always in charge of is how you want to feel afterwards. Now, you can choose to feel really miserable and come out of it and saying, I know I'm going to feel terrible because I haven't done my best. Or you can say, I did the best that I could with the resources that I had, and really feel that. And as we then I recommend, instead of running the tape of, and this could go wrong and this could go wrong, prepare for the presentation and then imagine coming out of it and feeling really good about what you've done. And maybe have going up to somebody and saying, yes, I did. I really rocked this. That really worked. And feel that pride.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily about somebody coming up to you and going, yay, you did really well. It's about us feeling it. That's more important than somebody telling us.
Yeah, it's that bringing that emotion into that. So it's not just a visual, it's the whole picture and how that actually feels. Yeah, that's really important. And, you know, and I know in particular your focus with what you do is working with women. You know, that's hence the interest to speak to you on the what are we doing here podcast, that's it. One of your things is talking about women is to be assertive. Tell me, because I know the first thing that someone's going to think that if you're being assertive, well then she's just a bitch and that's it, you know. And I look, I've worked with people who perceive that with me because I won't take the crap that they're prepared to take, and dealing with it in a way that I feel that I'm not compromising my value system, but mm-hmm. because their value system's different than mine, their perception of me is different. And that used to cut a lot deeper for me when people would perceive that, but now I know that I yeah. hang out with the right people who yes. perceive it as a bonus and a benefit, and they look up to me and as being able to do that, and that's what I encourage others to do. So I just, you know, so for you, that's really important as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. I do a lot of work with women in leadership roles, mm-hmm. and my experience is that women often hold themselves back because they don't want to be perceived a certain way. Women still want to be liked. A man often doesn't care.
Yeah.
And they have a very different way of actually putting their work forward. So women often hold back. They're just not being recognized as very competent because they often don't speak up. Because there is this whole notion of, you know, when a woman speaks up and, you know, we're too powerful, we're too this, and, you know, and I sit there and go, well, do you really want to look back at your life and say, should have, could have, would have? Mm-hmm. And I held back on fulfilling my potential because I wanted to make sure that other people around me didn't feel threatened by my competence.
And that's a really good term, isn't it? That's you know, I love that because that's where I stepped over the line of saying that why should I leave my life from other people who are threatened by my competence? It's nearly exactly the same words. I've just gone, oh my gosh, you've just, and it is, it's getting to that point, isn't it? That it's so yeah. hard though for women to do that.
Well, we've learned to do that. I mean, let me give you an example. The New York Times has just come up with an interesting scenario. Mm-hmm. They have created a new column called Overlooked. Mm-hmm. And Overlooked is obituaries in the New York Times that are actually about women, because they have identified that most of these obituaries were dominated by white men. And so now what they're doing is they're adding the story of remarkable women. So, right. you know, women who are not acknowledged for the contributions that they're making to the world. I mean, the first computer was developed by a woman. You know, mathematicians. I mean, there are all these women in science that have had no place because they were pushed out.
Mm. Oh, one of my favorite movies is that one that they've, and I'm just trying to think of the name, it's gone from me, is the one where the African-American women worked with the NASA project.
Yes.
I mean, that's phenomenal, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that happens over and over and over again. There's what's her name? She was a researcher who came up with, she did the first original research when it came to neurotransmitters and emotions. And her colleagues all got awarded prizes and you know, Nobel, I don't know if it was a Nobel Prize, but definitely really prestigious awards. And she was left off the list, even though she was absolutely crucial to the research. And where their offices became bigger and bigger and bigger, hers became smaller. The more she said, you know, there's other things that are impacted by emotions, because that was not approved of. Mm. I can't remember her name. Let's talk about something else, and it might come back.
The movie that's come back to me too was Hidden Figures.
Yes, and that.
You know, and that they had two counts against them. They were African American and they were women. And also it was the era that it was set in. But, you know, what I loved about it was the pilot that actually, you know, recognized the ability and relied on her knowledge, and that it was made about real women, you know, really smart women as well. So, yeah, it's, and that's especially in that era, and it still happens now, as you said, with this. That's amazing, those obituaries. That perception that you've got to hold back, that you can't be all that you could possibly be. It's sad.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I mean, you read, I'm going back to obituaries. I mean, what happens when you read obituaries for women? It's all about selfless, took care of the family, was always there for everybody, you know, was the charitable work. And it's all about definition through other people. Yeah. Whereas for men, it's often made a mark in the world, you know, just stood up for, it's a very different story.
Mm. Yeah, totally different. And it's when you ask people to, you know, to list the top 10 women that they admire, it's a real struggle for women to find and think of who they might admire in the world as well, because again, it's not publicized. I mean, the stuff with, and I'm not going into politics, whether Democrats or Republicans, but with Hillary Clinton, you know, that every time that she sort of pushed herself forward in that, it was just perceived quite differently. It's good that there are women leaders in the world like Angela Merkel and, you know, May, but again, they're strong women, but I still would believe that they're held back from being all they could be because of something that may, you know, look at what Margaret Thatcher copped but if that was a bloke doing the same things, it would be a completely different.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's why I love people like Jacinda Ardern, you know, who becomes prime minister and announces she's pregnant.
Yes, I know. Isn't that amazing?
I did a little happy dance.
Yeah, it's quite a different story, isn't it? And I'm a mother of grown sons, so it's watching them in the world and experience the world in business and that, they just have an expectation that it will be okay and it'll be done. And I mean, not all men are like that, but they just, if they want something, they state it, and they're very direct. Another men and women around don't judge them for being direct. It's just the way that they are. And, you know, then, and we listen to women's language. This is something that I learned a little while ago about listening to languages, is how someone speaks. It's, we use softening words. Women use softening words, may, should, could have, whereas men will be a lot more direct.
My favorite is when I run workshops, and women raise their hands and say, can I ask a question? And my answer to that is generally no.
Mm.
And they say, why? Because I said, I know you can ask a question. Do you really need to ask for A, whether you're capable of doing it, and B, my permission?
Yes.
This is, you know, this is an environment where we ask questions. This is a place of discussion. You don't need permission.
Mm.
And please don't question your ability by saying, can I ask a question?
That would certainly throw them, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it does.
The other one is apology, you know, that women apologize for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Drives me crazy. Yeah. You haven't done anything wrong. Don't apologize.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's cultural. It's very much cultural. And again, it's like I look at younger women and they don't have that as much anymore.
Mm.
I mean, it's just, thankfully, some of this is disappearing. But unfortunately, you know, it's like if there's one thing I would really like to change is that women support women much more than they currently are.
Yeah. Look, the women that I work with and am involved with the mastermind groups and that's where I'm loving that level of support within the groups, because they're all holding each other up. Neither of them, some of them are in the same fields, but it's still supporting each other, and it's a wonderful environment, and because it's only fear that pulls people down.
Mm, absolutely. Well, I've got a system that I developed to because I do a lot of work in emotional intelligence to describe when people manage their emotions functionally and when they manage their emotions dysfunctionally, when they also use emotions to create drama. You know, it's like when you put on your drama queen tiara and you go around and everything is terrible and you gossip and you bitch and moan about people, and that's men and women.
Mm.
But it's about, I call that fogging. We're creating fog. It's all about anxiety and putting people down, and it's not celebrating that. Whereas I have sunshine people on the other hand. So they're the people that lift us up, that help us get clarity, that help us shine.
Mm.
And when we have a circle of sunshine people around us, that makes such a difference.
Yeah.
But what we do is we just, again, we just sit there and go, oh, I shouldn't be saying anything, and I should really take this person's opinion on board because they probably know better than I do. No, probably not.
Yeah.
Just check what agenda they have.
I love that description of sunshine people. And it's really interesting. This is so timely. I'm writing the second book, and one of the chapters is about inner peace and inner calm. And one of the components of that is choose your words wisely. And it's not just what you say to others. And one of the things is don't say it unless it's true, useful, or kind. But one of the things is don't say inside what you cannot say outside.
Yes, absolutely. One of my favorite books is Don Manuel Ruiz, The Four Agreements.
Oh, yes. I've read that quite a lot. Oh, have I read it, or I've done some workshopy stuff on it? I can't remember, but I've heard of,
I mean, it's very simple. The first one is be impeccable with your words. And he says exactly that. Mm-hmm. Don't gossip about other people and don't speak badly against yourself. And we're really good at speaking badly against ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, it's that internal voice that where we have thousands of tape in our head of all the things that people have said to us, and we start really listening to that rather than observing what's happening in real life. Mm-hmm. We have a success and all of a sudden we talk our way out of it because it's like with my salsa dancing, you know, surely I can't salsa dance because I am so clumsy.
Mm-hmm.
I had to actually learn more to manage that belief rather than my feet.
Yeah. Well, that's it. And the webinar I ran this morning, we talked about belief systems and the, you know, because I'm, this will go to air after the Commonwealth Games, because I'm here and it's Commonwealth Games time and, you know, mm-hmm. I love it and I'm helping out and just enjoying the atmosphere on the Gold Coast. The belief system of how people believe, and the example I gave was Kate Campbell, that she believed in Rio she had to win because that was what was pushing her, whereas she took and didn't and wasn't successful, whereas she took time mm-hmm. out and changed her belief that she had to do her best.
Mm-hmm.
And now she's just blitzing the field. So it's again, is that those beliefs that you can't salsa. It really does make a difference, isn't it? But it's really hard for women because of that belief, again, that they have to look after the household and the children. And I mean, we birth children, so that's, you know, that's nature. It's part of the role, isn't it?
Yeah.
So how do we overcome that?
Well, I mean, I'm a very big believer in actually setting out guidelines where you negotiate with people how you want to deal with each other.
Mm-hmm.
We're very good at setting up systems for business. I mean, when I ask people, you know, it's like, who's got a system for how to deal with clients, how to issue invoices, how to make travel arrangements, pretty much everybody raises their hands. And as soon as I say, so how do you deal with, have you negotiated what you're doing, you know, how you're dealing with household chores, how you deal with conflict, how you manage disagreements and all of that, everybody just stares at me blankly and just goes, what do you mean?
Mm.
So negotiating those things and actually saying, let's do it this way. And, you know, it's like, and not just presuppose that the person's number you give to the school is the wife or the mother, but it could well be also the father. I mean, I have literally had a coaching session with one of my clients who had a message coming in, and he was one of those people who wouldn't turn his phone off during this session. I mean, you know, some people are really attached to that. Mm. And he looked at the phone and he sighed really deeply. After he looked, first he looked a little bit alarmed, then he sighed and he put the phone down and said, is there something that you need to handle? And he said, oh, my daughter has just gone into hospital. There's something that happened at the school. And I'm like, so you shall we finish the session and you go? And he says, no, my wife's handling it.
Mm.
And I said to him, we're finishing the session now. Do you really not want to go to hospital? He said, yeah, but my wife is handling it. I said, yeah, and you would be sitting here and doing what? And he said, well, I would be thinking about what she's doing, but that's her job. And I said, actually, it's not.
No.
And I said, how about we talk about that in the next session and you go and get yourself into the hospital.
Don't you love it when the universe presents a learning?
Yeah, we had a good discussion about it afterwards. Yeah. But again, it's just like there's often no guidelines around how do we deal with this? How do we deal with when we go into overload and when we need some help, you know, to ask for that? And women particularly are very good at just soldiering on and going, you know, it's like I have to fulfill this role of being a superwoman.
Mm, yes, we are. And it's when not being fairer to ourselves. And you know, if you're looking at it the other way, we're not being fair to the people around us who want the opportunity to assist us, either physically or emotionally.
Yep, absolutely. Mm. I totally agree. But we're getting bombarded with messages all around about how everything has to be a certain way. I mean, I call that the Cosmo Superwoman. Mm. You know, the Cosmopolitan magazine,
oh, yeah.
where they basically tell you, you know, you get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you put in a meditation session, then you get dressed and you prepare nutritious breakfast for the kids. You wake up your husband with a cup of tea or a cup of coffee when he's in the shower. You make sure that, you know, all of that is handled. Then you take the kids to school. Then you go into your high powered job. You deal with all of those things. You know, you have a light salad lunch while you go shopping to make sure that everything is organized for the dinner, because you have that dinner party at night. And then you prepare all of that while your husband watches TV and the kids do their homework.
Mm-hmm.
Then the guests come in, you have that lovely dinner. And at the end of it, you seduce your husband with a new sex position. You know?
I'm exhausted just listening to that.
I know, but it really literally is like that. I mean, there was one article that I sometimes use in my seminars where there was an article about how does he handle you earning more money than you do?
Right.
And what it did say, it was like, oh, just have some compassion with him. He probably doesn't understand that you need to excel as well. And you know, just make sure that every now and then you just not put yourself down, but just you know, make sure that he can feel like he's a real man. And right next to it, and right next to it was an image of all instructions for the new sex position, which was basically her being very, very passive and he was very active.
Oh my goodness!
I mean, I looked at that and went, "Are you kidding?" I mean, talk about giving people, especially young girls, the message that A, you shouldn't earn as much money as you're worth. Mm. You know, like, let's just pay you 60% of what men are getting paid. Feel guilty about it and then have to make up for it.
Yeah, and pamper a man's ego about it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? It's yeah, and I'm just thinking about I've just sort of diverted off track with that a little bit too. You know, getting the way things that we want done in the house. So, you know, it, contracts one thing, but nagging doesn't work. Is that what you're saying as well?
No.
Oh, I've been trying that for nearly 40 years, and I figured that doesn't work either.
No, it doesn't. I think that the one thing that we really need to avoid as women is to become our partner's mom.
Mm.
And nagging is a surefire of doing that, because if you really want to create a mom and dad relationship, that would be it. And I think sexual polarity is a really useful thing in a marriage.
Mm.
So yeah. I'd rather get a cleaner.
I'm with you. If all those redundant things that you just don't want to do, then get somebody else to do it as well. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. About 20 years ago, I started earning more than my husband, and he was in a good job. And his line was he just wanted to be a kept man. That was that was his ambition, was to be kept. So
yes, and
yeah,
how did the environment respond to that?
Oh, it's fine. Yeah, he actually continued working. He's retiring in mm-hmm. 2 weeks' time. So by the time this goes to air, he'll have retired. But he that was his thing. He just was quite happy for it. But I do see other people struggle, but it's still trying to, you know, mix all those. And I see this in women all the time. Again, they're doing all of those things that you were saying, and then they're having to clean the house. What do you do on the weekend? Well, I cleaned the house all day Saturday, ran the kids around for sport. But you're earning this money, get pay a cleaner that, you know, when you wake up Saturday morning, that's not your responsibility. Oh, I'd feel guilty if I did that.
Mm. And that's the crux of it again. We're back to beliefs and perceptions, and what will people think, and what will I think of myself if I'm not fulfilling some sort of outdated belief about who I should be?
Mm.
Well, I always say, please yourself. I mean, that's the person who looks at you in the mirror, and that's the most important person in your life.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, and again, if you devalue that, if it's something that's with you all of your life, isn't it? Mm. And looking, as you said earlier, looking back to go, wow, mm. I really It's sad. It then becomes something that is sad. So, and you said that you're working with corporate women. So how does, children and pregnancy, and we're talking about the Prime Minister of New Zealand being pregnant, and that's a reality. That's nature. That's what happens to women. We have children. That's, it's natural for us to be the nurturers around the fire and the men out hunting because we're looking after the children.
Yes.
But so how does that now work in how do you see that fitting into what we're discussing here?
Well, let me put it this way. I don't think that the corporate system was designed with women in mind. It comes from times where women were really the carers at home and men would do the hunting, as you said. Mm. And so now that that's changing, I think what we really need to do is the system has to change. I mean, if you want to look at countries where there's more happiness, more contentment, and where is countries where women participate more, where they have 50% of board participation. In Australia, what do we have? 8%? Mm. So if you look at the Scandinavian countries, it's a very different story. I mean, there's maternity leave and paternity leave. Men, and it doesn't necessarily mean the man, but in a relationship when a child is born or adopted or comes into the family any other way, both partners are required to take time off.
Mm.
We don't do that here.
No.
So women feel really guilty for taking time off. And when they come back and they identify that people have passed them by, or they're on the trajectory to being advanced and they're not quite there yet, there's a lot of either getting really ambitious and then making some really interesting choices. I have seen women just go completely overboard and rip themselves to shred in the process of that, or they basically give up. And they just decide that they're going to have another baby and another one, and then they stop everything they've worked for, and let me call it slightly judgmentally, to disappear into the suburbs. I have no problem with women choosing to be a full-time mother, absolutely none whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But please don't do it because it's too hard.
Yeah.
Because you think that you can't handle it.
And that's what often happens, is it all becomes too hard because of a whole lot of things we've discussed here. Is that perception within corporate as to what the role is, the woman's perception of herself as, to be super mum and not having that, not releasing jobs that aren't important as well, and not having that equal support from the partner. Perception there. There's a whole lot of things, isn't there, that causes that to happen.
Mm. Mm. So, I mean, I always one of the things that I advocate is actually small business. Mm. If you really want to do something, start running your own business. Well, you and I both know that doesn't mean that it's 9 to 5.
No,
but you can design your life around
Correct.
It.
Yes,
you can. You can make choices that you can't do, or you can't make when you work in corporate land. Mm. But even corporate land is becoming more and more flexible. Mm. So negotiate, ask for things that you want.
Yeah.
But you got to own your expertise and your competence in order to be able to do that.
Yeah. Look, Andrea, exactly right. I've been working in a sales manager role and a part-time sales manager for the last 4 years. And somebody, and I'm actually retiring from that role at the end of June as well, after 21 years with that same company.
Wow.
Yeah, so which is a very big decision. But they've brought on a new account manager who's sort of working in our team. And it's interesting, he stepped into this role and he's asking for things that there is another male account manager who has not asked for them as well. But it's basic, simple things about, no, I really can't drive the smaller car because I'm driving further distances. I need the larger car. His whole expectation of what is reasonable is very different than what mine has been, because it's just been acceptable as to what's been. And look, it's been incredibly generous, and everything's been worked well with what I've been doing. But again, that's that different perception of something, isn't it? So that expectation is different than what mine was and what the other account manager person was. And everything's being received as, yeah, sure, not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the other thing that I find so sometimes with men is, and I've had clients who would apply for a role, and I would say, so, you know, it's like, let's look at this together. And they'd say, yep, I really want to apply for this role. And I said, well, the job requirement actually claims that, you know, says you have to fulfill, you have to have this and that experience. And he said, no, I don't have that experience, but I'm going to rewrite it in such a way that it looks like I have. And I know I will be able to do it because I've done things that relate to that. So there's not going to be a problem. I'm confident that I can handle this. Whereas women often look at a job ad and or promotion or anything like that and go, oh, I have never done that and I can't do this. And they actually go by what they have achieved already. Mm. They don't look at potential. I mean, I'm generalizing here. Often when women look at men, they look at potential, but when they look at job, they look at what they've achieved.
I love that. When they look at men, they look at potential. That's a whole nother topic, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Please don't fall in love with men and their potential. I mean, I have literally talked to men and said, he's just like a diamond in the rough. He just needs a bit of polishing. Please don't do that. Fall in love with a man for who he is. When you hire a man, also ask, have they really done this or do they think they can do it?
Yeah.
My invitation.
Oh, I know. I've employed a lot of people over the years and I've got a little bit caught out sometimes when you're sort of discussing it, chatting with people and you've got them in for the interview and then you start getting a little bit more into the topic and you realize they can't do that. They haven't done that before.
Yeah.
But they talk it up. They talk it up well.
Yes. It's like going on dating websites and finding out that, you know, he loves walks on the beach and then you check and ask when's the last time he's gone for a walk on the beach. And that's a few years ago.
Just interesting question. Who was your role model in your life?
Oh, I'm surrounded by amazing women who just, you know, they just do things. I have a friend who became financially independent at the age of 45. Okay. And so she never has to work a single day in her life again. But because she can, she started a publishing house and she does all sorts of amazing things. And she's very smart and she creates her life. She doesn't find her life. She creates her life very consciously. Yeah. When I grew up, my mother, unfortunately, and I would have loved to say that was not my role model. She was probably my anti-role model. She was much in favor of me learning, but as soon as I took it to the level where I felt that I wanted to take it, it was too much. So she would say things to me like, you have a problem, Angela. You're a little bit too smart. Men don't like that.
Oh, all right. Okay. So, that's a good lesson still, though, isn't it?
Yes.
But a lot of people would listen to that, and it's somewhere in your subconscious that would have been heard as well.
And she said, the other problem you have, you're just not good looking. And that's a very bad combination. So I just came to a point where I just went, you know what, Mom, I can't change the way I look, but I can appreciate myself for who I am. And I will definitely not make myself, you know, keep myself small just so that I can, so that you don't have to feel that you don't, that you're not, because she is a very smart woman. And unfortunately, over the years, I have seen her, how she does exactly that. There will be things that she knows to talk about, but she doesn't, so that her husband will look good.
Yeah.
But I had a friend, my friend's mother, who was my surrogate mother. And she would do things. I mean, so this is a long time ago. She would go and do things where my mother couldn't negotiate going out with her girlfriends for dinner at night or for coffee in the afternoon without my father having to sanction this. This woman would go and there was one time when I came and saw them and she was busy cooking and freezing things and, you know, packing things. And I said, what are you doing? She said, well, I'm going to France for 3 weeks to do a language course. So I'm just cooking up stuff because I know that this is just in the too hard basket. So I'm just cooking food ahead of time and they can just heat it up.
Yeah. That is to have that comparison would have been because you saw a difference. See that a lot of children don't get the opportunity to see that there is a different way. Yeah. But you saw
I was 14. I said to her, what does your husband say about that? I was very well trained. And she said, she looked at me. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, how does he feel that you're going away? And she's like, why would he feel anything about that? Of course I'm going. You know, there was it was just such a very different family dynamic.
Yeah.
To the one I was used to. And it was just, it felt so much healthier.
Yeah, I travel a lot with a friend, and then every few years my husband, I can talk him onto a plane. But every time I go away, you know, is your husband going? No, I'm going with a girlfriend. Yes. Well, is that okay? Sure. Yeah. And my husband's going on a 3-month motorbike ride around Australia in mid-May, actually.
Oh, wonderful.
And which will be very exciting for him. He's been planning this for ages and ages, and just something he's been a big goal of his. And people going, aren't you going with him? Aren't you going to meet him somewhere? No, he's grown up. He can, we'll chat on the phone, I don't love him less because he's going on a thing and doing something for himself that is important for him. Now, we've nearly run out of time. This has been an amazing conversation. There's so much we could continue talking about.
Oh, yeah.
three very quick takeaway points. We've got about 5 minutes. So what do you want the listeners? Look, there's been an incredible amount of information in our conversation, but if you said these are the three things I really want you to think about, what would they be?
Okay, so the first thing, and that's really important to me, is stop buying into cultural perceptions of woman, what a woman is supposed to be like or supposed to be.
Mm.
You know, it's like your own unique self. I mean, as they say, you know, there's nobody out there like you, so stop copying other people, will never be like you. And, you know, you don't want to be like them either.
And different cultures would have different perceptions then too, wouldn't they?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And just become aware of what it is that drives you, because there's a lot of stuff out there where people go, but that's the way a woman is supposed to be. Well, there is no supposed to be anymore.
Mm.
That's the one thing.
Fortunately.
Yes. Oh. The next thing, embrace and love yourself for who you are, physically, spiritually, mentally, emotionally. That doesn't mean that you get away with, you know, really dysfunctional behavior of yelling, screaming, and shouting at people. But, you know, it's like, just honor yourself for who you are. You know, it's like, there used to be 5 supermodels in the world, and, you know, how many, 2.5 billion people or 3 billion women who don't match that.
Mm.
You just love yourself for who you are.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll never be perfect, but we will always be the best that we can be.
Mm.
And we can always upgrade, you know, as we learn. No, it's like you can always go from version 2.1 to version 2.2. But at the time, version 2.1 is the best version we can be at the time.
I suppose what fits into that particular one is recognizing that you can upgrade and that there is opportunity to upgrade, and then take that opportunity, isn't it? You know, it's not just, I mean, we can be happy with that 2.1 version, but once you know there is a 2.2, then is that then your responsibility to take on?
I would say that depends on whether you want to do this or not. I mean, have we got enough time for me to give you a little model?
I think I've got, yes, you certainly have.
Okay, so there's a book written by a mountain climber, Eric Weidenmeier, who climbed all the highest mountains in the world. And he came up with 3 different kinds of people. So obviously he draws from mountain climbing. The first ones are the quitters. Mm-hmm. And they're the people who sit in front of the mountains and go, oh, that's just too damn high. I'm never going to go there. And they're the ones who watch everybody go past them, climb the mountain, and they get very bitter the older they get and saying, I could have done that. Then there's the second type of person, and they're the climbers. Obviously, their goal is to get to the mountaintop. And then, of course, there's the third type, and they're called the campers. They're the people who climb up to a certain level, and then they look around and they go, oh, this is cool. And they pitch their tent, and that's where they're going to stay. There's nothing wrong with that, but just make sure that you're a happy camper when you do that.
And that's where that analogy is the happy camper. Yes. That's very cool.
And I think it's really pertinent because the guy who wrote the book is actually blind.
Oh, that's him. Oh, okay. So, yeah. Ah.
Yeah. So decide if you don't want to keep climbing because something else is more important. You just like the view. By all means, go for it. But don't diss the people who want to keep climbing.
Mm.
You know? Because they really need good base campers too. And also support.
Yes. Good support crew. Yeah. Excellent. And the third point.
Make friends with anger. Women are, and this is what we could speak for another hour. I'm really passionate about women and men expressing their anger in a really functional way. Dare to stand up for what's important to you. Negotiate behavior. When somebody behaves in a way that doesn't work for you, put boundaries in place. Walk away if need be and renegotiate when you come back. We don't do that. We either go into fight or we go into flight mode, and we do really stupid things when that happens that harm us, the relationship, and, you know, our success and our career. So stand up, develop the gravitas, the, you know, the calmness to be able to say, you know what, no, this is not working for me. But maybe we have lost the solution focus at this point. Let's talk about this at another time.
Oh, I think that's a very long conversation.
Yeah.
I'm sure we could get together and speak about. Look, that's just been wonderful. That hasn't that time has absolutely flown by. You've done well with the coughing. That hasn't been
I'm grateful, yes.
Too bad. And that just so how can people work with you? How can they get in touch with you, Angela?
They can go to my website, angelaheise.com. So that's H-E-I-S-E. And I've got information, there's information how to get in touch with me there. I do one-on-one coaching. I run workshops either for corporates or I also run public workshops. So there's a program that I run, which I'm really proud of. It's the Emotional Productivity Program that gives you all these skills that we've just talked about. That's the essence of over 20 years of working with people.
And you're based in Australia, so you're based in Brisbane. Actually, but you travel all over to run the courses and that, but it just helps the listeners because I've got listeners from all over the world as well. But you work online with people,
I would imagine, as well.
So, and so the website address, just again for those that didn't catch it, is Angela Heise, and that is spelled heise.com. Was there an AU on the end of that?
I'm being international.
Absolutely. There you go. And yes, look, there's just an incredible wealth of knowledge there. And I really trust that, you know, the women that have been listening have got some information that they then can apply within their own lives and take a little bit more control over what they create from their conversations with themselves and their actions.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Look, thank you very much, Angela. That has been a ton of fun. And that's another episode of the We Are Women podcast. And I do want to thank my guest again, Angela Heise. And please get in touch if there's something that you thought, wow, I really do want to work with her as well. All right. Bye for now, Angela. And to the listeners, bye for now. We'll look forward to you joining us on another episode of the We Are Women podcast. I am Janine Vosper, your host. Bye-bye.
So, do you feel stuck in a rut in business? Visit speechperfect.com.au and download Janine's free ebook to avoid the 5 most common stumbling blocks women face in business. It's jam-packed full of tips to overcome the barriers that could be holding you back from the success that you dream your business will be. We would love you to leave a review of today's episode and share this podcast with other women in need of entrepreneurial inspiration. Subscribe to the next episode now and join the We Are Women community.